This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. There has been a horrific mass shooting in Thailand. An emergency official says the death toll is at least 16, with an unknown number of wounded and the possibility there are still hostages being held. Hospitals are asking for blood donations. The location is the city of Nakhon Ratchasima, also known as Korat, northeast of Bangkok, where a soldier opened fire with an assault rifle in both a Buddhist temple and a shopping mall. The assailant is said to be still holed up there. 100 choppers and others have been evacuated. Thai police are warning people to stay away from the area as they try to capture and arrest the shooter. The American Embassy in Beijing says an unidentified U.S. citizen in Wuhan, China, has died from the coronavirus that he passed away 3 days ago. The death toll on the mainland has pushed past 700. Nearly 3,500 new cases have been diagnosed. AP correspondent Charles Ledesma reports five more cases have sprung up in France. The victims are British.
The announcement by the French health minister is the latest example of how the tentacles of the China virus can spread across multiple borders. The group, which includes one child, was staying in a chalet in an alpine resort and were in close contact with another Briton who apparently had contracted the virus in Singapore, then travelled to the French Alps, then tested positive for the virus upon returning to Britain. This brings the total number of virus cases in France to 11 now. Britain has three confirmed cases. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Ireland began voting today in a general election as Prime Minister Leo Varadkar hopes to win a new term on the back of Brexit. But observers say voters are likely to judge him more on his domestic record. Some 3.3 million people are eligible to vote to elect members of the Dáil, the lower chamber of parliament in Dublin. Varadkar's Fine Gael party has been in power since 2016, but polling suggests it is trailing the centre-right Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin, the former political wing of the IRA paramilitary group. From Washington, this is VOA News. While the spread of the coronavirus has been rapid, Africa has yet to be hit, but there are preparations underway there to deal with it if it comes. On Africa's escape so far, here is Lisa Schlein for VOA in Geneva.
This is of little comfort to WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti. She tells VOA, watching the virus reach other continents around the world is of great concern.
We know that there is quite significant travel of people from China to Africa and back.
Moeti says her team has begun working with member states to help them get ready for the possible onset of the coronavirus. She says WHO is providing overall guidance to ministers of health on how to manage possible cases and prevent further spread of the disease.
That was Lisa Schlein for VOA in Geneva. A high-level investigation into Australia's bushfire epidemic is said to be in the final planning stages, with Prime Minister Scott Morrison finalising the terms.
These fires have been fuelled by one of the worst droughts on record, changing in our climate and a build-up in fuel amongst other factors. Our summers are getting longer, drier and hotter. That's what climate change does, and that requires a new responsiveness, resilience and a reinvigorated focus on adaptation.
Morrison is getting some praise from environmentalists for including climate change in the investigation. Here in the U.S., Democratic presidential hopeful Pete Buttigieg says he would move the United States away from the politics of the past and that the next chief executive will be facing new modern-day challenges. His pledge came in the ABC debate among seven presidential hopefuls in the run-up to Tuesday's important Democratic primary in the state of New Hampshire.
Global health security, like what we're seeing coming out of China, to cybersecurity and election security challenges that were barely thought of a few years ago. And here at home, we're seeing things like gig work transform what it means to be a worker in America in ways that were barely conceived of not that long ago. We cannot solve the problems before us by looking back. We have to be ready to turn the page.
Among Buttigieg's targets, former Vice President Joe Biden, who did poorly in the Iowa caucus this week and who trails both Buttigieg and Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren in the New Hampshire polls. Eight people are reported killed and dozens injured in an outburst of violence in the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. The country's interior minister told a news conference about 300 people today fought on the streets of Masanchi. Gene Randall, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
President Salva Kiir has been showing leadership not only in the conflict that is raging in the independent South Sudan, but even during the liberation of Zambia. President Salva Kiir, whenever he sees conflict that might bring an end the struggle of the people of Southern Sudan, by then he accepts compromise.
South Sudanese President Salva Kiir plans to meet East African leaders about the implementation of the peace agreement.
People are dying here, the number of infected people is increasing, so now a lot of people are also helping and pushing for us to go back home. And yeah, I've received a lot of messages of people checking on me, even a lot of people that I didn't even know.
Africans living in Wuhan, China express concern about the ongoing lockdown due to the coronavirus.
There's no sign to show proof of the fire starting at Alakunda and then continuing to Kalilai. That's why people were skeptical and said we need to investigate.
And a major Gambian opposition party demands answers after fire engulfs former President Yahya Jammeh's residence. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. South Sudanese President Salva Kiir plans to meet East African regional leaders on the sidelines of the African Union Heads of State Summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Presidential spokesperson Atene Wekatene says the meeting will focus on resolving issues ahead of the full implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. For more about the president's plans to meet regional leaders, I read South Sudanese presidential spokesperson Atene Wekatene in the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
He will be actually talking to leaders of IGAD. There will be a tripartite sideline meeting that would meet before the African Union summit. And that tripartite would include President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, President Abdel Fattah al-Burhan of Sudan, who is the head of the IGAD countries, and President Salva Kiir to discuss measures of how to finalize the National Unity Government, which has remained now with less than 15 days to go. President Salva Kiir is also committed to ensure the implementation of the agreement is done once and for all to achieve everlasting peace agreements. So whatever that will come up during his meeting, President Salva Kiir is willing to listen to the leaders and also to give them his side of the story.
Some people blame President Salva Kiir for lacking the political will to see the full implementation of the revitalized peace agreement.
No, the opposite is true. President Salva Kiir is one who is very, very committed to ensure that, you know, peace and normalcy returns to the country. He is the one governing the country. He is not achieved. He is the one to benefit because he's the leader. If there is peace, then the first benefit goes to the leader of the country. So those who say President Salva Kiir is not willing to implement peace agreement, they are not saying the truth. President Salva Kiir is the only one among the stakeholders who is very, very committed and has expressed the political will to implement the revitalized agreement or a solution of a conflict in the country. Therefore, he has given enough than what is actually expected of him.
The Troika is asking for compromises from both the president and former vice president, Dr. Riek Machar, and other stakeholders. Will the president speak about issues of compromises when he meets the other leaders on the sides of the African Union meeting?
The president wants peace to prevail. And he's ready to listen to what kind of compromise that is actually expected out of him. And immediately he will actually agree on those compromises, provided the compromises are actually within the reason. Because President Salva Kiir has even given a lot before the signing of peace. He has accepted to have five vice presidents, something that is not presidented. And he has accepted also to give up some of his powers as president that was elected in 2010. So President Salva Kiir is already given enough of what is expected of a leader. So if there are compromises that would be proposed by his colleagues, if the stakeholders agrees to those compromises that the president is giving, then I don't see any reason why the transitional government of national unity would not be formed.
Stakeholders are saying that why are the leaders of South Sudan not showing leadership to bring this conflict to an end? Do you think that criticism is fair to President Salva Kiir that he lacks or has not been showing leadership in resolving this impasse?
No, if there is anybody showing leadership, it's President Salva Kiir. President Salva Kiir has been showing leadership not only in the conflict that is raging in an independent South Sudan, but even during the liberation of Salva Kiir. President Salva Kiir, whenever he sees conflict that might bring an end, the struggle of the people of Southern Sudan, by then, he accepts compromise for the sake of South Sudan. And there's no any reason why he cannot compromise.
So what should be the expectations of South Sudanese as he meets and discusses the peace process at the sidelines of the African Union summit in Addis Ababa on Sunday?
The expectation is that he will be coming back with the full go-ahead for the formation of the transitional government of national unity. And whatever remaining, those remaining sticking points, they would be done when the government is formed, and they will be done accordingly. So I'm expecting President to come back with the good news for the people of South Sudan.
Atene Wek Atene is the South Sudanese presidential spokesperson. He spoke with me from Juba. The American Bar Association, or ABA Center for Human Rights, has released a report revealing that the trial of a Ugandan academic, Dr. Stella Nyanzi, a Makerere University lecturer, was marred with irregularities and violations of her rights. The association is said to have monitored the trial as part of the Clooney Foundation for Justice Trial Watch initiative. The report highlights that the prosecution and conviction of Dr. Nyanzi for political speech constituted a violation of her right to freedom of expression. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached her lawyer Isaac Semakadi in the Ugandan capital Kampala for a reaction to the ABA report.
The report is a timely and welcome contribution to the improvement of our justice system. It, of course, shamed the National Bar Association. That is the major conversation in Kampala right now. That our National Bar abrogated its duty to monitor such a very important constitutional moment as the Nyanzi trial. Yet the American Bar Association invested the necessary resources to do this important work for democracy. As the lawyer representing Dr. Nyanzi, we feel vindicated. We feel vindicated because these were issues we raised before a High Court judge sometime in July without success. These are issues that have been front and center in the Nyanzi appeal, which was heard at the beginning of this year by another High Court judge at the International Crimes Division. And we are confident that we will be vindicated there. We did submit the preliminary report of the American Bar Association, which had been published in July last year, to the judge, because the mainstay of the Nyanzi appeal was lack of a fair hearing, breach of the procedure, due process rights that any accused person is guaranteed. And the judge, surprisingly, was interested in receiving the preliminary report. So I'm certain that the final report that was released on the 4th of February will be looked at in much more in-depth. We hope it will make a contribution to the outcome that we are expecting on the 20th of February.
Do you expect the judgment on 20th of February? But according to this report, the previous trial was marred with irregularities and violation of our rights. How confident are you of the appeal process in the country?
So we have some level of confidence because we fought for the right to have a white judge, a dispassionate judge, somebody who we felt is sufficiently insulated from the political shenanigans that we saw out that influenced the lower court's outcome and the other process we had in the High Court in July last year. To be specific, we really objected to former prosecutors who now wear judicial robes here in this matter, because in the view of Dr. Stella Nyanzi, and verified with the evidence, because she's now been part of the criminal police in Uganda for so long, these former prosecutors are nothing but second prosecutors. They use the judicial robe inappropriately to promote pro-executive pronouncements, which Benin and the grains they were blowing in Uganda. We were not going to accept any of it and appeal, and we didn't. We are confident of the outcomes on February 20th.
Regardless of the outcome on February 20th, just under 2 weeks from now, as Dr. Nyanzi has already been in jail for quite a long time.
That is true. Dr. Nyanzi has now served nearly 15 months of the 18 months to which she was sentenced, and according to Ugandan law, she's entitled to remission or reduction of sentence, which basically means that by the time the judgment is read, she should be able to be even released automatically, unless the judge decides to extend the sentence, in his view. But otherwise, for Dr. Nyanzi, it was important to make the stand that there is no liberty without freedom of right. So what we are fighting for in the appeal, the constitutional values that have previously been given lip service, and we hope that we shall get a judgment that communicates it to the entire political establishment that freedom of expression is the bedrock of democracy and human rights, and those who hold public office should respect this. We hope to change culture in the investigations department, in the prosecution department, and in the judiciary department. We were fighting for something more than just liberty. We are fighting for a change of culture within those that hold power in Uganda.
Isaac Samakadi is the lawyer for Ugandan Makerere University lecturer Dr. Stella Nyanzi. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kampala. A U.S. citizen in Wuhan, China, has died from the new coronavirus. Officials at the American Embassy in Beijing said Saturday that the 60-year-old American died February 6. So far, there are about 150 confirmed cases in at least 23 other countries. Meanwhile, critics accuse sub-Saharan African countries of failing to evacuate their citizens living in Wuhan. This following reports that countries in North Africa have evacuated their citizens. To learn more about the situation of Africans, I read Jean-David Koye in Wuhan.
The situation now is a bit sad. The lockdown is real. The streets are empty. The shops are closed in the majority, like maybe around 80%. As an African, I'm a bit sad because some of our fellow African, especially North African, they managed to leave. And Black African, yeah, like Sub-Saharan Africa is still there. And, yeah, we are trying to struggle and survive until this lockdown is over.
Have you heard from your various government or senior government officials or diplomats in China?
As for Ivorians, we were a bit lucky. From the first day of the lockdown, we got in touch with the ambassador and we expressed our worries and our needs. So we got some financial help from the state of Ivory Coast that we already received. The first need was to leave Wuhan, but they instead sent us some financial help for now, from what they said. So we are hoping that they are working on the evacuation of the Ivorians in Wuhan, and I guess that will be the best solution.
What about some of your other compatriots from other African countries or sub-Saharan African countries following the evacuation of the North Africans? Have you heard anything from them?
I heard lately that the Republic of Kenya wanted to evacuate its people, but today I got some news from one of my friends that the government, or I don't know if I can say it, the minister maybe, that said that the students are safe. They are more safe in China than in Kenya. I was a bit disappointed to read that, but maybe that's also a sad truth. But I just feel like as Africans, like as sub-Saharan Africans, we have been left in the Chinese hands. Yeah, like our governments really did not work well on that part. Some got financial help. I think Congolese got financial help as well. Even people from Senegal, yeah, Senegalese as well. But about the evacuation, no sub-Saharan African countries have left Wuhan yet.
So how are you surviving since the entire Wuhan is on a lockdown? How are you able to buy your groceries or even order food for yourself? How are you surviving?
So first of
not ordering food. It's been more than 2 weeks. I can say even 3 weeks I didn't order food because I don't think it's safe, because we had some stories about some delivery guys that got infected. But about surviving now, 2 weeks now we are on lockdown, and I went outside 2 times. So those 2 times were to buy groceries. Yeah, it's only big supermarkets like Walmart and Carrefour that are open. So there are a lot of people that go there. There are not a lot of staff, but if you go there early as well, you can find something.
So have you received any assurances from the authorities in Wuhan about how things are going? Because we understand the infections keep growing.
Yeah, sadly, today we are about to reach, I think, 30,000 people infected soon. I don't know if I can call it assurance, but what I know, they are trying their best to contain the virus.
What messages have you been getting from back home, not only in Ivory Coast, but some of your colleagues from other parts of Africa?
On the first days, I was actually a bit sad because when it came out and the media and all talking people, I was actually really scared that we actually go back, because we were asking for the Ivorian state to take us home, but people were in the majority against it. But when I think now they see that people are dying here, the number of infected people is increasing, so now a lot of people are also helping and pushing for us to go back home. And yeah, I've received a lot of messages of people checking on me, even a lot of people that I didn't even know.
Jean David Koye is an African living in Wuhan, China. He spoke with me from Wuhan. And the World Health Organization is scaling up measures to keep Africa free of the deadly coronavirus by shoring up the continent's fragile health system. This by increasing preparedness efforts to tackle the potential spread of the dangerous virus to the continent. WHO reports 31,211 cases, including 637 deaths inside China and 270 cases in 24 countries and 2 deaths outside mainland China. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The novel coronavirus has been moving with breathtaking speed since it was first detected in China's Wuhan city in December. While this pneumonia-like illness has been expanding to more countries around the world, it so far has not penetrated Africa. This is of little comfort to WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti. She tells VOA, watching the virus reach other continents around the world is of great concern.
We know that there is quite significant travel of people from China to Africa and back. So business people, both Chinese people working in different African countries, and we have an intense travel of African business people, particularly going to China. So we are concerned.
Moeti says her team has begun working with member states to help them get ready for the possible onset of the coronavirus. She says WHO is providing overall guidance to ministers of health on how to manage possible cases and prevent further spread of the disease. She says the experience gained in tackling the Ebola epidemic in the Democratic Republic of the Congo can be applied to a possible outbreak of the coronavirus on the continent.
We recognize that our countries have invested quite a bit in preparedness for the ongoing Ebola outbreak in the DRC. And we are seeing that in some of the key areas, that readiness is being now deployed in relation to this coronavirus outbreak.
WHO has identified 13 top priority African countries, which either have direct links or a high volume of travel to China. They include important hubs in countries such as Angola, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, and Zambia. Moeti says screening methods developed to detect people who might carry the Ebola virus are now being deployed at airport points of entry to spot people who might be carriers of the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The spokesperson for the Gambia's Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction Party says its leaders plan to meet to demand an independent inquiry into a fire that engulfed the residence of former President Yahya Jammeh. Duduja says the party wants to learn more about the origins of the fire. Officials say it was a bushfire that engulfed the former president's residence. Ja tells me that the fire appears to be a cover-up because the former president's residence was looted of all valuables and furniture.
When we first had the information, we saw pictures of it and live videos of the inferno. It was definitely an inferno that was very intense. And the villagers, they did everything they could to put it off. But the information we get, they said it started from a village called Alakunda. And that village is a bit far from Kanilai. Not very far, but a bit far. And in between the village and Kanilai, there's a road, like a pathway, which definitely, even if fire engulfs or starts from Alakunda, how can it keep the road, you know, going towards Kanilai, his home village? But we believe perhaps people are behind it in trying to burn down the place because most of his properties there have been looted. Valuable items have been stolen, you know, from the place in Kanilai. And just a week, we had information that people were sent there, whether it was from the government, you know, or authorities came from somewhere. They were ordered to go there and remove all the furniture, even the bed. And the corrugates on top of the ceiling were given command that they should remove everything. But the soldiers that were stationed there, they told them, no, they will not allow that to happen. They went back and came again and said, it's an order. They said, whoever gave that order, they are not going to accept that to take this property. So we definitely don't know the issues behind this, why they want to burn down the place. Perhaps it's to cover up for the valuable items being stolen, you know, at Kanilai.
Some people have called for an independent investigation to find out if this was deliberate or not. What is your party saying about this?
Yeah, because when the fire started, they said they contacted the fire service station at Kanilai. They said their vehicles had a breakdown. They contacted Birkama. Those ones said they were busy. I think they contacted Bandul. They said the managing director was in a meeting. It's like nobody wants to take any steps to put up the fire. So it was definitely an issue. That's why people, especially us as a party and the residents there, they said definitely an independent investigation has to be launched to see what was the cause of the fire and who had the people behind.
But Dodu, why are you being suspicious? Couldn't this be a natural bushfire?
Bushfires are not very common in our country. We don't have that intense heat that would warrant a bushfire. History could prove that. What we're saying is the information they we received, they said it started from a village called Alakunda. And Alakunda is a distance from Kanila, and there's a road that separates the two villages. So how can the fire skip that road and engulf Kanila as a village? This is very fishy. You know, knowing the geographical location of the area and people, I myself have visited that. So when they said it started from Alakunda, definitely that cannot start from Alakunda and shift to Kanila because it's not joined. You know, there's a road that separates the two villages. And there's no sign to show proof of the fire starting at Alakunda and then continuing to Kanilai. That's why people were skeptical and said we need to investigate. And the commander in charge there, by the name Commander Kurubali, the villagers there especially have alleged him of stealing some properties within there, smuggling it out and going to sell it. So if you put a commander in charge of such a place, who himself is definitely on most occasions, people are alleging him that he's stealing valuable properties and smuggling it out of the palace. Definitely we will be skeptical about the whole issue.
Have you officially petitioned the government about your request for an independent investigation into this?
Not yet. We will have an executive meeting in a few days and we'll look at the issue discussed and see what measures we should take, you know, in order for that to happen.
But how are your supporters reacting to this latest development?
But honestly, most of them are taking in good faith, especially when the villagers fought the fire and put it off. Definitely, people were very worried that the whole palace could have been burned down because without the people and some of the soldiers stationed there, if they haven't intervened in putting it off, it will definitely all will burn down to ashes. Even some of the soldiers there, they didn't lift a finger to do anything in putting off the fire. And people were worried, and they're suspecting that government is behind it. You know, as militants, they have every right to do so, especially when you are an opposition party and the government is doing everything to clamp you down or to suppress you at all costs or whatever happens to your point in that government. And they're restricting people from taking care of the place or having access to it. So when you deny that to the people, especially the villagers and family members, then definitely you need to take care of the village yourself, because it's a private property and it belongs to a former head of state.
Dudu Ja is the spokesperson for the Gambians Opposition Alliance for Patriotic Reorientation and Construction Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Kenyans on Saturday morning lined up the streets of the capital, Nairobi, to view the body of the late President Daniel Arap Moi, which is lying in state at Parliament Buildings. Moi died Tuesday while receiving treatment at a Nairobi hospital. As the period of national mourning that was declared Tuesday by President Uhuru Kenyatta continues until Moi's burial Wednesday, the death of the country's second president continues to receive mixed reactions from Kenyans. For VOA, Ryle Ombo reports from Nairobi.
Throngs of Kenyans Saturday morning lined Nairobi streets, waiting to enter Kenya's parliament buildings to view the body of the country's second president, Daniel Arap Moi, who died Tuesday at the age of 95. President Uhuru Kenyatta, in the early hours of Saturday before heading to parliament, eulogized the former president in a live televised broadcast from Status Nairobi, his official residence.
Today, as a solemn procession of the late President Moi's remains proceeds through the streets of our nation's capital to lie in state at Parliament Buildings, we commence the final journey of a great son of Kenya, a cherished brother, a loving father, a mentor to many, a father of our nation, a champion of Pan-Africanism, and the second president of the Republic of Kenya.
Kenyatta and First Lady Margaret Kenyatta were the first to view the body before other Kenyans, most of them admirers of the former president, got their chance. Rebecca Andisi was happy to see the former president for the first time. She said, "I remember Moi as a president who helped people. People would go to him and he would help them. He paid school fees for our school children. May God rest his soul in eternal peace." Moi served as Kenya's president between 1978 and 2002. He took over the presidency on the death of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta, in 1978. In 1982, he pushed a constitutional change that converted Kenya into a one-party state. He ruled the country until 2002, when a coalition of Kenyan opposition parties led by Mwai Kibaki won an election that was termed as the country's first free and fair elections. At the height of his presidency and the clamor of a multi-party state in Kenya, Moi's regime was accused of serious rights violation, including torture and even political killings of opposing voices. Timothy Njoya, a retired Presbyterian Church of East Africa minister, was one of the main faces of Kenya's opposition at that time, as was Mwa Kenya, an underground movement that was fighting for a multi-party democracy in Kenya. In a 1986 sermon, Njoya told his congregation that they had God-given rights to question their government, and that no one should let others make up their minds. He would then hand copies of the sermon out to his congregation. He was assaulted on several occasions for his activism and alienated from the church.
It was voice of reason versus violence, versus actually brutal violence. We couldn't give up. All the Kenya intellectuals, the Kenya people who are critical of Moi and Mwa Kenya, all those people who were called by Moi four big words: disgruntled, distant, malcontent, subversive. All those people came to the pulpit on the sixth.
The church restored him to ministry in 1991. He would preach the 1986 sermon several more times after he was reinstated. Kenya finally became a multi-party state in 1992.
To accept multi-party instead of going to a civil war, which other stupid dictators would have done, like in Congo, in Somalia, in Sudan. Many stupid dictators would have preferred to go to civil war than repent. So that's one way I give Moi a tick. and a passport to go to heaven. So now he has died peacefully, in peace with all people, with his family. I think that he earned that peace. And he earned the respect he's getting by those two events. The only redeeming grace for Moi is to accepting Motepati and accepting new constitution. That is his legacy.
The former president's supporters credit his leadership style for the maintenance of Kenya's stability when other African countries were falling apart, riddled with military coups and civil wars. Kenya's government announced that Moi would be accorded a state funeral, the sixth state funeral in Kenya, and the second after Kenya's first president, Jomo Kenyatta's, in 1978, to have full military honors. The burial date has been set for Wednesday. Rael Ombor, VOA News, Nairobi.
Hundreds of people have marched in the Cameroonian capital Yaoundé calling for the cancellation of Sunday's local and parliamentary elections in favor of a transition which will put an end to the long-serving President Paul Biya regime. The protesters say only a transition will lay the foundation for democracy. For VOA Moki, Edwin Kenzeka reports that the government has again insisted that the elections must be conducted on Sunday.
These are the voices of at least 500 men, women and youths dressed in black, singing as they marched through the streets of Cameroon's capital Yaoundé Friday. They sang that Cameroon needs a political transition to end President Paul Biya's 38 years in power, not the local and parliamentary elections the government is organizing on Sunday. 58 political parties, including the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, some old opposition political parties, such as the Social Democratic Front, Cameroonian Democratic Union Movement for the Defense of the Republic, and the National Union for Democracy and Progress, are taking part in both elections. All of them say they are going into parliament to enact laws that can solve the crisis Cameroon is facing. Among the leaders of the protest is Kawala, president of the Cameroon People's Party and former presidential candidate. She says Biya's dictatorial regime has rigged the system and can never be ousted in an election. Kawala says she is certain that if the elections take place, Biya's Cameroon People's Democratic Movement Party will still have a majority that is loyal to the long-serving leader.
We are not going to have a parliament that will be able to do any better than the outgoing parliament has done, nor mayors who will be able to do any better. Yes, to political transition. We need an end to this regime. We need reforms of institutions, including the electoral system, and then we can talk about elections.
Kawala said she was calling on all Cameroonians to join protests for a transition because it was unfortunate that since Biya became president of Cameroon 38 years ago, he has been deaf to calls for electoral reforms the opposition has been clamoring for. The protests were organized by Stand Up for Cameroon, a movement launched by five opposition political parties, including Union of Cameroon People, MANIDEM, and the Cameroon Renaissance Movement of Maurice Kamto, who claims he won the October 2018 presidential election and that his victory was stolen by Biya. Stand Up for Cameroon says its objective is to create for a genuine political transition in Cameroon. Minister of Communication and Government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi says Biya enjoys legitimacy after a landslide victory with 71% of the vote in the 2018 presidential poll, with Maurice Kamto in a distant second with 14%. Sadi says the elections must take place as planned and that any person who wants to disrupt it will be arrested.
It is surprising that some leaders of political parties are today putting forth various considerations, either to boycott the elections or to simply demand their postponement. A vast majority of Cameroonians are also legitimately and impatiently aspiring to take part in the twin elections, whose importance is secret to no one.
None of the protesters were arrested in the march that apparently surprised the government and the police. Opposition parties have always complained of widespread irregularities, insecurity, and low turnout in Cameroon's elections. They say Biya, who has been in power for over 40 years, 7 as prime minister and 38 as president, uses his party's parliamentary majority to rule Cameroon with an iron fist. Separatist fighters have also vowed that the elections will not take place in the English-speaking regions and impose a travel ban in the northwest and southwest regions. Civilians are fleeing the English-speaking regions where there have been battles between the military and rebels. The civilians say they do not believe the government will be able to protect them. Cameroon says polls will be opened on Sunday from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Vote counting starts immediately afterward. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And a former vice chancellor for Christo University of Zambia is calling on President Edgar Lungu to establish a commission to solve issues related to tribalism in the southern African country. Academician Dr. Lawrence Mwawa says there seems to be a sharp increase in cases of tribalism across the country. If not quickly resolved, he says, the country's social and moral fabric could be seriously damaged. To learn more about the issue, I reached Dr. Lawrence Mwawa in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
People make comments about tribalism, and then we want to pretend as nationals that there is no tribalism. But the reality is that tribalism does exist. And if we are going to deal with this problem, I said, we must not be hypocritical about it. We must be honest, and we must face the fact. If we cannot call for an endeavor, let the government appoint a committee or a commission of inquiry to investigate this and come up with recommendations on how we will be able to deal with the issue of tribalism.
Are you saying that the situation is really bad, that there has to be an investigation in order to resolve this issue? And what do you suggest could be the resolution of this problem that you see?
It has never been this bad, but it appears to me that year after year, it is getting deeper and deeper, nasty, especially when you hear comments from people in public offices making comments pointing to that. So if we are pointing to this, if we are referring to this, it means that there is a problem. And any problem can only be resolved after admitting that the problem exists. The moment you do not admit a problem exists, you are not going to deal with a problem.
Why do you think tribalism is pervasive, and who are the perpetrators of it? And why do you think that your call for an independent inquiry into this could lead to a solution to resolve this problem?
I don't want to blame anyone, but the fact remains that our actions, our deeds display tribalism. So to stand up and say, hey, it's because of this one is the one who is propagating tribalism, I will be lying.
What do you think is the best way forward to resolve this problem of tribalism that you spoke about? Because it appears that a lot of Zambians are expressing concern about it. Have any political parties expressed concern about it?
So the best way is to sit down as brothers and sisters in Zambia and say, let's talk about this issue and then let us deal with it honestly, than to point fingers at that one is the one who is propagating it. Each region, it's embedded in them by the law of familiarity. They want to identify with their own. Now that we are in a unilateral state, in one state where we have to work together, we have to be honest and come to a round table, come to an endeavor and say, let us stop this.
So how have Zambians been responding to your call so far?
Well, most of them do agree with me that we need to honestly face this issue and deal with it than to pretend as if it is not there. And yet when we are in the dark corners, we talk about tribe.
Why do you think this has been cropping up since multi-party democracy was introduced in Zambia?
It's human nature. We always want to identify with our own. It could not only be tribe. If I have got my brother and yourself competing for one thing, I'll obviously support my brother as opposed to supporting you. Isn't that a fact of life?
How has been the reaction of political parties, including the ruling Patriotic Front Party, about your call?
Everyone says we must stop tribalism. And in most cases, I've seen people pointing fingers. That one is tribal, he's making tribal sentiments. But I don't think that's the solution. The solution is agreeing, yes, this is a problem. Let's sort it out. Let us sit down as brothers and sisters and talk about it and find a way to sort it out.
What role do you see the church mother bodies or religious groups, including civil society, playing in this effort to find a solution to what you described as the Zambian problem with tribalism?
The challenge which is there, and the way I see it, this problem has even gone into the church, in the church, inside the church, and that is not how it is supposed to be. The church is supposed to lead, especially preaching from the point of Christ, that we are one. We are supposed to be one because we all belong to one Father. We all belong to one God. And so the church must come in and preach oneness. That is what the church must do. Bring everybody together and say, can we please stop this?
Academician Dr. Lawrence Mwamwa is a former Vice Chancellor for Kristo University of Zambia. He spoke with me from Lusaka. Right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Diamond Platinum with Otani Penda, followed by Brenda Fassi with Noma Kanjani, and then Bisakade with Mansa. Juliana Kanyamozi ends it with Sanyu Liange.
Shabiki zangu, waloni sifu kwa maneno matamu. Leo mati zangu, nimitusi tu kwa Instagramu. Kimwana statangu, eti nayanifamu. Hata wuna ize kimpigia, ananifukia kama salamu. Na magazeti nyumbani kwa kuku savari, sunajuaga. Utasikia tafarani timoni kwa zari, amemwagwa. Na venye nilivyo nyonge tabia ya kwa jibu.
No.
baba bila mificha ni confidential ukisayumba sana unanisije kwa kichekesho wana rafiki wa jana ndio adui mkubwa kesho
Thank you. That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, cross the river in a crowd and the crocodile won't eat you. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.